All of our patrons will automatically qualify for our exclusive prize draw. At the end of the season, 8 of them will be randomly selected and written into one of the thrilling chapters of Season 5. To enter, click the link in our description and sign up as a patron today.
Our children are delicate, innocent little people that we must protect. Their minds are still adapting to the world around them. In most cases, what kind of adult they will eventually end up to become is still undetermined. It is up to us as their parents to guide them, teetering on that balance between protecting them from pain and allowing them to experience life in a way that helps them grow. We want them to understand the dangers of the world, and yet we want to shield them from ever having to experience them. It is easy to feel like no matter what you do as a parent, you're making the wrong choice. It is not hard to blame yourself for every mistake or misstep, but it is, unfortunately, all too easy to understand why it is so essential that we keep our children vigilant. It is a sad reality that not all who cross paths with us have good intentions. The true boogeyman is not waiting in their closet or under their bed. They are walking by you on the streets. They are lurking on the internet, or watching from afar. A way to ease this fear into the lives of children without destroying their innocence too abruptly is to share stories of this boogeyman creation. It is an abstract idea of a monster, a being that comes in no particular shape or size, with no particular goal or agenda other than to target children. However, to the people of Staten Island in the southern borough of New York City, this abstract boogeyman has been given a very specific name. My name is Luke Mordew, and this urban legend is Cropsey. We all know the boogeyman, even though we all acknowledge that its description varies from person to person or town to town. It is a diverse being, one with many faces and guises. Some see it as a weeping bride, others as a monstrous figure. To some, it is a crocodile-like hag or a simple shadowy shape. The list of how this being can manifest itself in our horrors makes it one of the most consistent and vague beings in all of folklore. However, in Staten Island, the boogeyman has become a lot more grounded in reality. Here, it is a man made of flesh and blood, lurking in the shadows, although this makes him no less terrifying to those who hear his tale. So what is it about the specific boogeyman? Why does a story from such a small part of our world hold such weight? It is likely down to the grounded way in which the story exists. This is not a spirit or a witch. It is not an entity or otherworldly being. This boogeyman is a human. One that over time has caused very real horrors. In my telling of a fictionalized encounter with Cropsey, we will follow Antonio, Tommy, George, and Adam, passing the time on a very hot summer's day. The air was thick and sticky across Staten Island. The sun was beating so hard against the pavement that it had begun to cook. People stood outside their houses, relaxing in the shade as they chatted away, fanning their faces with folded newspapers and magazines. It was a Saturday, and everyone seemed content with not having to go to work, focusing their time on doing nothing until the sun would finally begin to wane, so the cool night air could soothe the city once again. However, this heat wouldn't hold off the area's children. As Tommy, George, Adam, and Antonio gleefully strolled down the street together, each gulping down their cans of fizzy drinks they'd just bought from the local store with their pocket money. They were in deep conversation about which of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles they were, with the group in agreement that Tommy would don the red, whilst George would be orange and Adam blue. The only one who seemed to have a problem with their specific turtle was Antonio, who had been assigned Donatello. It wasn't that he didn't like the character, and he quite liked purple. He just resented that he was always lumped as a smart one, never the fast or strong one. This would have been a quality he would have grown to enjoy about himself if given the chance. But at this moment, he wanted to be bigger like his friends, who were already inches above him in height. He sighed, agreeing with them as he threw his now-finished can into the trash can on the other side of the street. However, it bounced off the rim and landed on the floor beside it. The other boys laughed whilst Tommy stepped forward, throwing his can directly into it. They were being mostly playful, but it just seemed to rub in the lack of physical ability he seemed to have. "We should play Boogeyman," Tommy suddenly called out, as if the trash can had somehow given him the idea. "What's that?" Adam asked, already slouching at the thought of playing any game in this heat. Tommy began to pick up pace, heading towards the wood ahead that spread off past the houses, causing the others to progress forward in an effort to keep up. "Someone is it, and they have a home, like a tree or something. The others have to run and hide, whilst whoever's it counts to 21. "This is called 40-40, Antonio exclaimed, recognizing the description. Tommy shot him a fierce look, scrunching up his face of annoyance. "Or we call it Boogeyman," he snapped back before continuing his description. "The people hiding have to make it to base without being seen. Then you have to shout, 'Home safe!' If you're seen, you have to beat the Boogeyman back to home." The boys nodded in agreement, but Tommy instantly took this chance to dart forward, already sprinting ahead as he shouted back, "Last one to the trees is the Boogeyman!" The boys groaned in annoyance and began to pace forward. Antonio pushed with all of his might, but he knew he was about to be lumped with the task of being it. He was always lumped with it. He wasn't that much slower than George, but he was a year older and had a little more length and strength to his stride, meaning he would always have the upper hand. Tommy slammed his palms against the first tree in the wooded area, quickly followed by Adam. They both turned to watch George and Antonio straggling behind, cheering them on in excitement. Antonio was all but ready to give up as they arrived at the T-junction, prepared to dart across the road so they could come out at the trees. But as they did, a car suddenly appeared, slamming on its brakes, just in time to avoid hitting George. In his panic, he paused, placing his hands on the car and shouting to the now furious driver that he was sorry. This was Antonio's chance, as he darted around the car, flung over the pavement, brushed through the grass, and slammed his entire body against the tree in an embrace. George arrived shortly after, slowing his pace in disappointment as the boys laughed together. Adam threw his arm around Antonio, squeezing him whilst exclaiming, "Good job, buddy!" It was clear that George wanted to fight the results, most likely ready to argue that the car made it an unfair race. But instead, he sulkingly walked to the tree with a quiet sigh. "Is this tree home?" he asked. "It is," Tommy replied as he scanned the woods ahead of them, as if laying out a battle plan. George turned to the tree, placing the palms of his hands on its bark at head level, before leaning forward and resting his face onto the back of his hands, covering his eyes before chanting, "One, two." The boys instantly charged ahead, disappearing into the trees in different directions, signaling to each other to stay away as they edged closer. By the time George had reached 21 and turned to face the woods, they were nowhere to be seen. Tommy had gotten low, ready to slowly creep his way to the base without being detected. Adam, on the other hand, had gone high, climbing a tree and clinging onto a thick branch. Although he had quickly realized this was not the best of decisions, as now he wasn't sure how to move without making it very clear where he was. Antonio, on the other hand, had kept it simple, crouched down behind a large root spread across the ground. His plan was simply to get closer and closer behind the thicker of the trees. He chuckled to himself, excited to be one of those hiding on the first go. Usually, he wouldn't get to unless the others had taken pity on him. But this time, he had earned his place in the game. He peered over the root ever so slightly, keeping his head down as low as possible, just enough to see George increasingly surveying the area. A twig snapped in the treetop to his right, most likely from Adam trying to gradually make his way across the branches. This caused George to dart forward in his direction, keen to find its source. This would be an excellent time to move, so Antonio pushed off the ground and shot forward, arriving at a tree a few feet away. He quickly spun as he arrived, slamming his back against it, pushing his body as close to it as possible, now facing the trees into the distance. However, now he could see something strange up ahead. Deeper into the woods, it had become overgrown and dark, as if the treetops above had created a ceiling of green over the cool ground below it. But it did not stand alone. Amongst it, he could make out the shape of somebody standing by the shrubbery, watching the boys play. It could have just been the way the shadow sat. The figure hadn't moved an inch, although, if a man was standing there, they were very tall and wide. Antonio watched the figure curiously, wishing that he had brought out his glasses to see more clearly, but he always hated having them on his face. "I see Adam!" George's voice suddenly echoed from the distance, followed by a large thud on the ground. Antonio turned to see that George had run back to the tree to announce he had sighted Adam, who had fallen from the trees in his panic at being sighted. Whilst laughing together, Adam clambered back to his feet, pacing towards George as they discussed what had just happened. Antonio turned back to the trees in the distance, still dark and filled with shadow, although the figure had seemingly moved. He panned around the area, his eyes darting to the trees nearby to see if he could see anyone. But it seemed that nobody was there. He sighed and returned to the game once again, now seeing George dart around with newfound confidence after finding Adam, who now sat by the tree, watching the play unfold. At one point, George was only a few feet away from Tommy, who had laid flat beside a small bundle of sticks, somehow keeping out of George's sight. Antonio smirked, letting out a little laugh as he watched it unfold. It seemed as though Adam had also clocked the situation, as he too had begun to laugh, calling out to George to distract him, helping Tommy along the way. They were all having a good time as George shouted out to them with taunting words, trying to get some sort of reaction from them. But amongst this was a strange sound coming from behind. A faint, curious noise, as if somebody had whispered to him, trying to get his attention. Antonio turned back to the trees behind him, but he could see nothing amongst the greenery, the only movement being the shadows of the leaves dancing on the floor. Tommy had seemingly decided it was time to make a break for it, and suddenly jumped from his hiding spot and charged for the trees. George yelped in a playful panic, chasing behind, but it was already too late. Tommy had beaten George back there by quite some time, laughing about how skillfully he had maneuvered his way around him. They discussed it further, all laughing together as Adam congratulated Tommy on his win. But during this conversation, something caught Antonio's eye again. A few trees along from him, he could see what looked to be a hand resting on the bark, although the fingers were so dark and muddy that they almost completely blended in with it. He questioned whether what he could see was, in fact, the hand of a large man, or if it was simply part of the tree itself. He didn't want to call out to the others, ruining the game, only to find out that he had become afraid of a tree. He would never live it down, and he felt that today he had finally proven that there was more to him than they had anticipated. He turned back to the boys, who had still not begun to look for him, chatting away as if having a break without him. He contemplated moving, but it seemed odd to play whilst they were not. And so he let out a little whoop to remind them that he was out there, teasing George, who sharply turned to the woods. Tommy laughed as he sat down beside Adam, discussing the events as if sport commentators. George had begun heading into the trees again, tauntingly calling, come out, wherever you are. The game was back on, and it was time to focus again. Although, this became difficult when Antonio turned his head. Now, Peering around the bark was a large man's face, his eyes greying and faded. His skin was seemingly covered in so much dirt and muck, but that his skin was almost impossible to decipher, as if he had crept up from the earth itself. The man smiled at Antonio, watching him with excited eyes as he raised a small, rust-covered axe gripped tightly in his hand. Antonio hesitated for a moment, filled with so much fear it seemed to fill his lungs, momentarily freezing his nerve endings. Still, he managed to move his feet, quickly turning back to the boys and letting out a scream for help. But before he could even finish this one-syllable word, the mysterious figure had caught up to him. George arrived at the scene moments later, desperately trying to find him, confused about how he had vanished so fast. None of the boys had been alarmed by the sudden call. As to them, it was merely Antonio taunting George once more with another strange sound. The boys would eventually join in to help, struggling to find him, but before long, they would begin calling out that he wasn't playing the game properly, before giving up and announcing that he had won. Frustratingly for them, nothing they did brought young Antonio forward. Eventually, they would grow further irritated, claiming that he was taking it too far, even suggesting that he had perhaps left as a prank. Either way, they announced that they were leaving and continued their day. Because of this, hours would pass, with the sun well and truly set before Antonio's parents would call to ask where their son had gotten to. The kids would at first claim they didn't know before thinking a little harder and admitting that they had last seen him in the woods. At the time, they thought it would either lure him out or end the prank that he had pulled. At no point did any of them believe that anything untoward had happened to Antonio. But unfortunately, they would later come to realize that they would never see their friend again. That night, Tommy would struggle to sleep, riddled with the guilt that told him that he had abandoned his friend. He kept thinking about the yelp he heard from Antonio's mouth the last they heard of him. It replayed through his mind as he looked back, trying to find anything that he may have missed. However, in the darkness of the night, he heard something else, as if harmonizing with the sounds of his memories. It was Antonio calling out once again. Tommy jumped to his feet and darted to the window, looking out onto the street below to see if he could see anything. He was higher up in the tower block, giving him a vantage point of the world below. But unfortunately, he could see nothing. He wondered if he had perhaps imagined it. It was dark after all. But then something caught his eye. Past the trees in the distance sat an old abandoned building that nobody dared enter. Usually, he couldn't see it in the darkness of the night. But tonight, it stood out as inside one of the broken windows, a light was on. It emitted a warm, dim glow bouncing off the grey walls inside. A square of light amongst the shadow of Staten Island. Inside, he could see the large shape of what seemed to be a man looking out into the trees. And it was at this moment that Tommy had a thought that sent a shiver slithering over the skin of his entire body. The boogeyman was real. The story of Cropsey was a popular urban legend throughout the 1970s and 80s, almost entirely limited to the borough of Staten Island. He was always described as being an escaped mental patient or homicidal madman, becoming a real-life Michael Myers to the locals. However, Cropsey's tastes were more particular, as he would only come out at night, lurking in the shadows, waiting for the opportune moment to snatch away children, dragging them into the dark. Other urban legends and horror movie cliches had even found themselves blending in with his narrative, as his weapon of choice would consistently be described as either a bloodied axe or a hook for a hand. Children in the area were taught to fear the existence of Cropsey, ensuring that they didn't venture off too far and stayed vigilant for any looming strangers that may carry sinister intent. He was said to live in the darkness of the vast tunnel system below the streets. This could be the incomplete subway tunnel intended to connect railways on Staten Island to the BMT 4th Avenue line of the New York City subway in Brooklyn, now sitting abandoned as the job was eventually discarded. More commonly, though, the stories would refer to the eerie tunnel system under the abandoned ruins of the old Seaview Hospital, a former tuberculosis sanitarium. With the building crumbling away and discarded, the remains had become haunting, eerie places to see, with little to no signs of life for many years. The idea of these tunnels below the borough would give Cropsey a perfect system to get around without ever being seen. It gave way to the notion that he could drag a child away, disappearing down a hole that the general public did not know was there. It didn't matter how far they would look for you once you were down in those tunnels. You would be lost forever, never to escape, not even in death. Although, some stories placed him in the Seaview Hospital building itself, looking out onto Staten Island, instead using the tunnels to get around and venturing during a hunt. The story of Cropsey was famous amongst the children of Staten Island, although it wasn't taken too seriously by most, widely understood to be nothing more than a warning story from parents. Simply a scary story to share around the campfire to spook your friends at summer camp. Stories would be shared of apparent sightings of Cropsey within the camp at night, watching the children from the darkness of the trees. Sometimes he would be described as nothing but a shadowy figure, with no way to accurately describe how he looks, whilst at other times he would be defined with a lot more detail, suggesting that he was covered in burn scars over his entire body. Counselors would use whatever version they fancied that night to warn the children to behave around the fire and stay in past curfew. Once the popularity of Michael Myers' escapades in the 1978 classic Halloween boomed across cinemas worldwide, film producers everywhere tried to cash in on the idea. Slashers had become a necessity for many studios, with many sticking to the holiday themes of Valentine's Day, Black Christmas, Friday the 13th, and more. Around this time, a young Harvey Weinstein was looking for a way to break into the film industry. And after noticing the slasher craze was at its heights, he decided to produce a film inspired by the scary story he had grown up around. This brought Cropsey to the silver screen. Although he carried a pair of gardening shears instead of wielding an axe or a hook for a hand. Although this wasn't all they changed in the Cropsey story. Instead of being another madman who escaped from a generic mental asylum, he was presented as a janitor named George Cropsey, a perfectly normal member of society. However, due to a prank by a group of summer camp counselors going very wrong, he is set on fire, causing severe burns across his entire body and face. 5 years later, and after consistent skin grafts and a burning rage inside of him, he escapes the hospital and makes his way back to the camp. Here, the story changes further, as he no longer chooses children at random, but actively seeks out the camp staff in revenge, now showing elements of Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger combined. These stories were a little way to warn children, to invoke a little healthy fear in their hearts. However, little did anybody know that whilst they used stories to bring out a bit of horror, genuine horrific events were taking place right under their noses at Willowbrook State School. Here, events occurred that to this day are marked as one of the United States of America's darkest moments in history. By the time Senator Robert F. Kennedy toured the institution in 1965, Willowbrook was home to over 6,000 intellectually disabled people. This is already a significant number as is, although it only becomes worse when we learn that the maximum capacity for this building was 4,000, and this overcrowding contributed to a disgraceful sight. He proclaimed that those inside were living in filth and dirt, their clothing in rags, in rooms less comfortable and cheerful than cages in which we put animals in a zoo, whilst offering a series of recommendations to improve the conditions inside. If this wasn't bad enough, it was also home to what has been called one of the most unethical medical experiments on children in the entirety of the United States. It would eventually come to light that the medical staff within this facility had been purposely injecting otherwise healthy children with the hepatitis virus, causing many of them to become very sick as a result, all in the name of scientific research. Unfortunately for the children inside, many of them had been entirely abandoned by their parents and the foster care system, resulting in little to no understanding of the events unfolding inside beyond the walls of its building. It would eventually be reported that the children had been subjected to consistent sexual abuse and corporal punishment. The beginning of the end to all of this would come thanks to the actions of a small few. The first was Jane Curtin, who visited Willowbrook to cover a demonstration that social workers and the residents' parents had organized. She wanted to get inside to better understand what was happening and was granted entry by social workers Elizabeth Lee and Ira Fisher. Accountability for these disgusting crimes against human lives would not come until 1972, when a young Geraldo Rivera published the most famous expose on the matter, revealing the horrific conditions inside, resulting in the eruption of a national outcry. The expose was called Willowbrook, The Last Disgrace, and quickly became a sensation, with Geraldo eventually winning a Peabody Award for his work on it. As a result of these revelations, a class action lawsuit was soon filed against the state of New York by the parents of the residents in March of 1972, known as New York ARC versus Rockefeller. Willowbrook State School eventually changed its name to the Staten Island Development Center. However, it would still officially close 15 years later in 1983, when the number of residents had dwindled to just 250. No level of rebranding would help defeat the haunting memories that lingered around it. The publicity this expose had brought forward would eventually contribute to the successful passage of federal civil rights legislation, one that protects the mentally disabled and others who have been institutionalized. The last children left the grounds of what was once Willowbrook State School on September the 17th, 1987. Once the horrors had been exposed, things had seemingly begun to change, and the dark cloud that hovered over the people of Staten Island could finally clear. Better days would surely lie ahead. But unfortunately for the residents of Staten Island, the connections to that awful place would return, and their fear for their children would only intensify. Soon, it would become clear to them that, somehow, the story of Cropsey that they had shared for so many years had come to life. I hope you're enjoying this chapter so far, and we will return to it. But first, I wanted to steal you away for a moment. I love what I do, and delving into the history of urban legends and folklore is as fascinating as it is rewarding. I feel fortunate to have thousands of people listening to my research each week. The kind messages I receive are both heartwarming and reassuring. However, it takes a very long time to create each chapter. And no matter how much I enjoy it, doing this for free is not always a possibility, leading to significant gaps between seasons, gaps that I hope to shorten in the future. And this is where your support is needed. Through Patreon, you can subscribe for as little as £3 a month, less than a latte at your local barista. By doing so, you will receive all episodes without any advertisements or breaks. You will also be able to listen to each chapter the Friday before the general public. On top of this, you'll receive a weekly newsletter and discounts on merchandise. We're not just building a community there, but forging a fellowship of folklore enthusiasts. Join our private group chats, where you can share your stories, theories, and discoveries with like-minded individuals captivated by modern myths. Let's discover what you've heard, what you may want to hear, or what you think of any specific legend. Your support on Patreon isn't just a subscription. It's an investment in preserving our urban legend show. Please help us continue our journey, and in return, become part of our team. Visit our Patreon page by clicking the link in our show notes, clicking subscribe, and paying whatever you can afford to give. I look forward to your support as we continue to unravel folklore together. And now, back to the legend. On the 7th of July, 1972, a five-year-old little girl named Alice Pereira was playing with her brother in the lobby of one of Tyson Lane's apartments on Staten Island. It was around 3:30 in the afternoon when her brother briefly left her alone. But when he returned, she had vanished. There had been a reported sighting of her in a park nearby later that afternoon. However, this was never confirmed, and unfortunately, little Alice was never seen again. At 6:15 p.m., her mother reported her missing to the police, who had first suspected that her father had taken her due to Alice's parents' divorce. However, before long, he was cleared as a suspect. 5 years later, an 18-year-old Audrey Lynn Nirenberg lived in the Brooklyn borough of New York City. She was no longer attending school as she was living with disorganized schizophrenia. This was a subtype of schizophrenia, manifesting itself with increased difficulty in daily function, including speech and emotional expression. Since the age of 15, she had spent several brief stints in psychiatric health centers, even occasionally staying in a local adult daycare. In July 1977, she was an outpatient of the Kingsborough Psychiatric Center in Brooklyn under a doctor's supervision. According to her family, she was doing quite well at this stage of her life. She was now on medication and was perfectly okay without constant supervision. She could now venture off into town on her own without harm, although it is said that she would occasionally get lost. Between the 13th and the 14th of July, New York City experienced its famous blackout during extreme heat, leaving over 9 million people without electricity or air conditioning. Audrey's father, Milton, had caught wind that parts of nearby Staten Island still had power and air conditioning. They decided to drive down, visiting the Jerry Lewis Theater on Mariner's Harbor. They watched a movie, had dinner at a fast food restaurant, and went home, feeling slightly fresher due to a night out under some cool air. The following day seemed normal. The power regained and life continued. Her father, Milton, had headed off to work whilst her siblings Stephen and Brenda ventured off to school, leaving only Audrey and her mother Evelyn at home. At around 2 p.m, Audrey told her mother that she was heading to the local store to buy cigarettes. It shouldn't have taken long, but as you may have suspected, she would never return. Not long after her disappearance, on the same day, an unidentified man would phone the Nirenberg household claiming to have kidnapped Audrey, now demanding a ransom in exchange for her release. Milton would instantly alert the FBI to this, who would send plainclothes officers to stake out the house in case he rang again. But they left after only 3 hours of waiting. And the caller has, to this day, never been identified. Milton believes that the caller could perhaps have been nearby and had seen the FBI agents entering the home, even in their plain clothes. At first, the detectives theorized that Audrey may have broken down and struggled to find her way home. It has been reported that she did have a habit of repeating her actions, leading some to hypothesize that she may have retracted her steps back to Staten Island from the previous night's trip. Others point to the strange owner of a local ice cream parlor. Audrey had previously accused him of sexual assault, although he claimed to authorities that it was nothing but consensual sex, and no charges were ever filed against him. Suspiciously, only 3 months after she had disappeared, he sold his business and moved out of state for good, but not before cementing over a large hole in the wall of the ice cream parlor. Whether this was checked up on is unclear. A year after this, on the 20th of July 1978, a 44-year-old woman, Shin Lee, was reportedly walking home from the Staten Island Developmental Center at close to midnight when she suddenly disappeared off the face of the earth. However, on this occasion, authorities found her a few weeks later. She was buried in a shallow grave in the woods beside the facility she worked at. She had been strangled. 2 months later, in the early morning of the 24th of October, a 42-year-old woman named Ethel Louise Atwell parked her car behind Building 47 at the Staten Island Developmental Center, where she also worked. Two female employees inside the building would hear a male voice outside say, "Come on, come on," resulting in Ethel replying either, "No, you'll beat me," or, "No, you'll hurt me," before letting out a scream. They checked outside, but due to the darkness and lack of streetlights, it was challenging for them to make out what was going on. When the police arrived, they would find a tan pocketbook, one earring, one black shoe, three black coat buttons, and part of a set of dentures beside her locked car. Around 75 feet away, they would also find her keys in the nearby woods. But unlike Shin Lee, they would never find her. 3 years after these attacks, on the 15th of July 1981, a 7-year-old girl by the name of Holly Ann Hughes was sent to the Port Richmond Deli on Staten Island by her mother. It was only 2 blocks from her house, and she should have returned swiftly. However, the last time she would be seen was at 9:30 p.m. when she bought the soap. It was immediately apparent that upon her return home, something had gone wrong. A month after this, Holly's distraught mother, also named Holly, would receive a phone call from a man going by the name of Sal. He would claim that he had imprisoned her daughter, and that if she would meet him to engage in sexual activities in front of a camera, he would return her daughter safely. She would meet this mysterious caller, but, of course, would be accompanied by detectives. However, Sal never turned up. She would later admit that she never believed that this man honestly had her daughter, and by now, she believed her to be dead. It was August the 14th, 1983, when an 11-year-old girl by the name of Tyahese Jackson disappeared. Last witness leaving the Marina's Harbor Motel on Forest Avenue on Staten Island, where she lived with her 3 siblings and mother. After a fire had broken out in their home, they lived here whilst figuring out their eventual move to a southern state. It was 1:30 in the afternoon when another motel resident sent Tyahese to purchase some chicken wings from the Crown supermarket. Her mother was asleep at the time, taking a midday nap. Although when she woke up 3 hours later, she would find that her little girl had never returned from this trip. On the 9th of June 1984, a 22-year-old man named Hank Gaforio was out drinking. First, he had gone to a bar called Mugs Away, but was unfortunately declined service. So he made his way to the Spa Lounge in the Port Richmond neighborhood. He stayed there until it closed at 4 a.m. and presumably began to make his way home. Although, he would never arrive. Those around him considered him to be what they refer to as slow, with an IQ level notably below average, making him a somewhat vulnerable victim for anyone who may mean him harm. He would be reported missing that evening at 7 p.m., but unfortunately, he would never be seen again. 6 years would pass before another case of a Cropsey-like mystery would be uncovered, when Jennifer Schwager, a 12-year-old girl born with Down syndrome, disappeared. It was on the 9th of July, 1987, that she set off for a short walk. However, in fitting with the pattern, she would, unfortunately, never return. Authorities in the local community banded together to try and find the lost girl, leading to a grueling 35-day-long search. Although, once again, this story would have no happy ending. A retired firefighter named George Kramer had led two searchers to a spot he had discovered around the Staten Island Developmental Center. The area had been combed through several times. However, on this occasion, George noticed something that seemed off, a spot of land where clay had mixed with darker topsoil. The volunteers he had flagged began to dig in the spot, until they would eventually unearth Jennifer's body. Numerous missing persons accounts are happening all around the world daily. However, I have chosen those specific cases due to the connections they all have with each other. And that connection is the legend of Cropsey. It was easy to see the strange correlation between these horrendous crimes and the mysterious figure lurking amongst the darkness, the boogeyman of Staten Island. It jumped out of the realms of imagination and scary stories and manifested into reality with a trail of horrors behind it. But what was truly happening over these years? Would it turn out that the legend of Cropsey was in fact real? The answer to that is not simple, as the myth itself was, theoretically, nothing more than a local legend shared amongst those who lived in the area. However, in several ways, and to many worldwide, the legend had well and truly come to life in the guise of a man who embodied the essence of evil. Frank Rostam Roshan was born on the 11th of March, 1944 in Manhattan, New York. Not much is known about his childhood, and his sister would confirm that they were average people. It would not be until his teenage years that things began to change. His father would die, leaving the children with their mother, who had also now been institutionalized at the Pilgrim Psychiatric Center in Brentwood. In his early 20s, Frank became a custodian at Willowbrook State School, the very same that the expose would later unearth. Between 1966 and 1968, he filled an orderly and physical therapy aide role here. However, he would do so under a different name, now working as Frank Buschetti. Whether he was involved in any of the wrongdoings that would later come out about this place, we will never know. Although, the more we learn about Frank, the more we will see just how troubling his presence inside truly was. It was less than a year after leaving his job, on the 5th of May, 1969, that he had been arrested in the South Bronx, charged with the kidnapping and attempted rape of a 9-year-old girl. One he had enticed into his car and driven to a vacant lot. Luckily for the little girl, a passing police car spotted them and interrupted the crime just in time, as he had already undressed himself and her. He pleaded guilty to sexual abuse and was sentenced to 4 years in prison, although he would only serve 16 months, getting out in January of 1972, when he would go by a different name once more, now known as Andre Rand. It was only a few months after his release that Andre was working as a painter in Tyson Lane Apartments, the very same area where 5-year-old Alice Pereira vanished that July. There was nothing concrete about this. However, it was difficult to ignore his coincidental connections to the case. For the sake of objectivity, it is also worth noting that there were likely several people with menacing pasts within the vicinity of the missing girl at the time. That said, it's not hard to see why people find Rand's connection to the mystery extremely suspicious. The case of 18-year-old Audrey Lynn Nirenberg is far more speculative, with some suggesting that as she arrived back at Staten Island in her confused state, she very well may have crossed paths with him. Here, the world building around this man begins to grow, with questions arising on whether many of the mysteries around Staten Island were, in fact, the evil doings of their new local boogeyman. The cases of Ethel Louise Atwell and Shin Lee are widely considered to be victims of Andre Rand due to the locations of which they occurred, on the grounds of what was once Willowbrook State School. This was only enforced later when further damning crimes would be discovered in the area. However, it is worth noting that neither Ethel nor Shin Lee fits the types of victims Andre Rand would usually go for. A few years after these murders, in 1979, Andre Rand was accused of sexually assaulting a young woman and a 15-year-old girl. But unfortunately, neither officially pressed charges against him. The mystery of 7-year-old Holly Ann Hughes in 1981 delves deeper into the lore of this real-world Cropsey figure, as Andre Rand was officially questioned by police regarding her whereabouts. However, no charges were pressed against him at the time. Holly's mother would later identify the voice she heard from the phone call she received as the same as Andre Rand's. On top of this, several witnesses would claim to have seen Holly sitting in Andre Rand's vehicle. He would even go as far as to admit that he had actually met Holly and had even played hide and seek with the young girl the day that she vanished, before giving her money to buy some soap, as she was, as he described, filthy. He claims that they had already parted ways by the time that she had reportedly vanished. The police would also realize that Andre Rand's aunt lived in the same apartment building as Holly's family at the time, giving him ample opportunity to have seen her before. Andre Rand's defense team would insist on his innocence, suggesting that those who claimed to have seen Holly in his car were either mistaken or just outright lying to pin it on their client. Their tactic was to shine a suspicious light on Holly's parents instead, as they had been in the midst of a custody dispute for some time, and Holly had actually been taken away by both parents at one point or another. However, they had been cleared as suspects by the police early on in the investigation. Andre Rand would go on to serve 25 years to life in prison for the kidnapping of Holly Ann Hughes, although he was never charged with her murder due to a lack of evidence for a conviction. Even so, this kidnapping conviction would not happen until much later, in 2004, long after the events had taken place. In regards to 11-year-old Taya Heese Jackson, who disappeared on her way to buy chicken wings in 1983, it was later noted that at the time, Andre Rand had a campsite at the Baron Hirsch Cemetery, which was located around half a mile from the Mariners Harbor Motel where she lived. Her mother would even claim that she had seen a curious-looking man loitering in the motel's car park before her daughter's disappearance, a man who matched the description of Andre Rand. That same year, he would pick up a group of 11 children from Staten Island YMCA whilst driving a school bus. Without any of their parents' knowledge, he would go on to buy the children food before taking them to Newark Liberty International Airport. Nobody was harmed in this strange encounter, and Andre Rand would eventually be apprehended, serving 10 months in jail for unlawful imprisonment. When 22-year-old Hank Gaforio went missing after a night out at a spa lounge a year later, the police tracked back over his time the night before, and it is here they would discover that he had been spotted sitting in a diner during the early morning hours, joined by none other than Andre Rand. Later, another connection would be made when it was realized that Hank Gaforio and Andre Rand even resided within the same block, just around the corner from Little Holly's home. When 12-year-old Jennifer Schwieger's body was found buried on the grounds of Staten Island Developmental Center in 1987, the police conducted a thorough investigation of the area. Here, they would come across one of Andre Rand's makeshift campsites with notable proximity to the shallow grave. In 1988, Andre Rand was charged with the kidnapping and first-degree murder of Jennifer. However, the jury could not reach a verdict regarding the murder. He was, however, convicted of first-degree kidnapping, putting him in jail for 25 years to life. This would have allowed him to apply for parole in 2008, if it was not for the 2004 conviction of Holly Ann Hughes, ensuring he would never be free again unless he managed to gain parole at 93 years of age. Whilst in prison, it is said that he would confess to Holly's murder to another inmate, comparing himself to serial killer Ted Bundy. However, this is impossible to verify and, as always, should be taken with a pinch of salt. Andre's story would spread worldwide thanks to the documentary written and directed by Joshua Zeman and Barbara Brancaccio in 2009. The documentary, simply titled Cropsey, suggests that some detectives believed Andre could have been involved in Satanism, with his role being to provide children for sacrifice. However, it's worth noting that this was the 80s when the satanic panic was rife. Andre Rand will now exist in the borough of Staten Island as mythically as the Cropsey tale directly associated with him. He is now famous amongst true crime fans and horror story seekers. There is no doubt he was a sick and twisted individual. Although, just how much of his story truly collided with the last moments of these victims, we will never know. There has never been any actual physical evidence against him. And although most believe that he is, quite obviously, the culprit, nobody can honestly say for sure that this is the case. This was a man capable of dark and disgusting things. One who had proven himself to be a dangerous presence around children and the vulnerable. Take this fact, throw in the way he lived his life, very much camping in different parts of the borough, somewhat off the grid, and you have the mysterious figure that looms nearby very much coming to life. On top of this, there is the apparent dark cloud that floats above the grounds of what was once Willowbrook State School, with the horrors against vulnerable children happening behind closed doors, locked away from everyday life. Andre Rand's connection to this school only darkens his character. We will never know how innocent his time working in that building was. But still, the association with those horrors do nothing but mold him further into this Cropsey-like figure. There are now many stories surrounding the tale of Andre Rand, some of which are true, many of which are nothing but urban legends themselves, added to the account for a blackened flourish. If you are to search the story of Cropsey online, you will only be met with pictures of Andre Rand. No longer is the boogeyman standing in the shadow of Staten Island. Now, he has a face, a story, and a name. Lines were beginning to be drawn between several mysteries and any correlating evidence that placed Andre Rand at the scene. Now, of course, it's possible that Andre Rand is responsible for each of the puzzles I've covered here. It is also likely that he's involved in crimes that I haven't. However, we have to acknowledge that when we turn a story to legend, it opens us up to misinformation, flourished facts, and confirmation bias. Andre Rand is now officially the boogeyman of Staten Island. He earned that title through his heinous acts. But let us not forget that in this sense, boogeymen are everywhere.
Urban Legends is researched, written, and produced by Luke Mordew. Original score by Billy Jupp, with additional sounds from storyblocks.com. If you like what you heard and want to hear more, click subscribe on your chosen podcast provider and delve into the mysteries of our previous and future chapters. To find more, including merchandise, video content, images, and more, visit urbanlegendsfolklore.com. If you have more information or a correction on something mentioned in this chapter, please get in touch through our website. We aim to ensure that all information provided is accurate and up to date, and this remains a top priority. If you want to support the show, receive early access, and have more of a say in what we do, then become a patron by clicking the link in our show notes. For these chapters in video format, simply search Urban Legends Folklore on YouTube. Follow us on TikTok, Instagram, and Threads, and join our Facebook group by searching Urban Legends Folklore.